Yet the other source of knowledge available, intellect, was also realized on all sides as imperfect if better, and unable to stand the test of experience. It could become as deceptive as the other ways. For intellect was logical thinking, and Archbishop Whately had once proved, with perfect irony, that logically we were well entitled to doubt the historic existence of the great Napoleon. Logical induction was quite useful so far as it went, but it was too incomplete to yield finality. Its results were always liable to change with further experience. There was something in all these three ways which man needed for balanced living. I had used this combination for years, taking guidance from the words of men deemed wise, that is authority, from my own sensitive feeling in meditation and ecstatic absorption, that is mysticism, and from the check of self-doubt and self-criticism, i.e. intellect. Indeed, I had prided myself on being a rational mystic and on refusing to be cast in the conventional shape. Yet even the totality of this combination did not suffice to unveil a truth that need never be revised. Was a further and finally satisfactory source of obtaining knowledge available? This question also demanded an answer. None of the Maharishi's devotees had ever posed himself these problems, so far as I knew, and consequently my own inability to obtain any further enlightenment from him would probably have been attributed by them to the insatiable spirit of inquiry engendered by my poisonous modern Western education. Nevertheless, I respected and revered the Maharishi for his unusual attainment in mental quiet, for few others had so successfully ascended that psychological peak, and that might have sufficed to have kept me at his side until this day, as a friend even where I could not stay as a seeker after truth, bearing in solitary resigned silence the gnawing questions which he could not answer. But during my last two visits to India it had become painfully evident that the institution known as the ashram which had grown around him during the past few years, and over which his ascetic indifference to the world rendered him temperamentally disinclined to exercise the slightest control, could only greatly hinder and not help my own struggles to attain the highest goal, so I had no alternative but to bid it an abrupt and final farewell. Fame is the inexorable penalty of success in my profession, jealousy is the unwanted penalty of fame, and hatred follows as its ugly fruit. Low manners eventually win the courage of their verbal vituperation and stoop to threats of physical violence. I realized, however, that I must cling to this precious talisman from the Buddhist Dhammapada: among men who hate us, let us dwell free from hatred, and that nobody should be exempt from the wide sweep of compassion. Nevertheless, these bitter experiences of life taught me severely the exact price to set upon that fragile thing which is verbal human friendship and outward show of holiness. Those who cannot understand are always prone to misunderstand. But the rare ones who, through fine temperament or altruistic experience, instinctively reach out their hands through the world darkness quite compensate for the hurts caused by malicious lying ignorance. With them we are members of an unseen church that unites those who were born dedicated to leave their corner of the world a little better than they found it. What is the meaning of the world? It is time to take up anew the train of thought which I have been recording. Graduation from the Beyond Yoga. Formula for analytic contemplation of who am I? To what am I? Did not end there. Both questions still came within the purview of mysticism, and the painful logic of certain events had finally and fully clinched what the logic of critical reflection had begun to reveal. I became acutely aware that mysticism was not enough by itself to transform or even discipline human character and to exalt its ethical standards towards a satisfactory ideal. It was unable to link itself thoroughly to life in the external world. This gap was too serious to be ignored. Even the emotional exaltations of mystical ecstasy, wonderfully satisfying though they be, were fleeting both in experience and effect, and have proved insufficient to ennoble men permanently. The disdain for practical action and the disinclination to accept personal responsibility which marked the character of real mystics prevented them from testing the truth of their knowledge as well as the worth of their attainments, and left them suspended in mid-air, as it were. Without the healthy opposition of active participation in the world's affairs, they had no means of knowing whether they were living in a realm of sterilized self-hallucination or not. Meditation apart from experience was inevitably empty, experience apart from meditation was mere tumult. A monastic mysticism which scorned the life and responsibilities of the busy world would frequently waste itself in ineffectual beating of the air. The truth obtained by contemplation needed to be tried and tested, not by pious talk but by active expression. A so-called higher knowledge which fails to appear in homely daily deeds was badly learnt and might be nothing more than vacuous vagary. The true sage could be no anemic dreamer but would incessantly transform the seeds of his wisdom into visible and tangible plants of acts well done. Emotional exaltations won through religious devotion were indeed personal satisfactions but might become dangerous illusions when they failed to find a proper external balance. Society represented an opportunity for the spiritual dreamer to examine the truth of his dreams and to test the strength of the castles he had built in the air. But to do this he needed to change his attitude towards the despised world of activity, to stand intermittently aside from his dangerous ascetic pride, and to broaden and balance his outlook by intellectual culture. Time, experience, and thought had thus proved faulty and incomplete the theory which tradition had turned over to me of a shortcut to the kingdom of heaven, and in the end silently pointed away and bade me continue my quest elsewhere. Mysticism was an important, necessary and generally neglected factor in human life, but it was only a single and partial factor after all, and could never do duty for the whole of life. A more integral culture was needed, one which could be perfectly rounded by reason and which could survive the test of every experience. Such a culture could only come from facing the fact that man was here to live actively no less than to meditate passively. The field of his activity was inevitably out there in the external world, not here in the trance world. Whilst the practice of meditation did lead a man to a certain degree of self-knowledge insofar as it penetrated the strata of his thoughts and feeling to their more peaceful foundation, it did not lead him to self-sufficiency. This was because the external world was always confronting him on his return with the silent demand that it also be thoroughly known and properly understood. Unless therefore he inquired deeply into its real nature and united the resulting knowledge with his mystical perception, he would remain in the twilight and not in the full morning sun, as the entranced mystic thought himself to be. Most mystics in attempting to know themselves metaphorically shut their eyes to the profounder enigma of the surrounding world, but that act did not lead to its dismissal. The last logical extension of this argument led one to perceive that the significance of self would inevitably become clearer when perceived in its proper place within the organic unity of the whole of existence. For just as a completely correct view of any part of a machine was possible only from the standpoint of the whole machine itself, so a perfect view of the individual man was also possible only from that of the universal existence in which he was included. One had to learn to distinguish between the trembling touch of quarter truths, the hesitant feel of half truths, and the firm grip of the whole truth. The old Asiatic tale about the four blind men was instructive. They wanted to know what an elephant was like, so they asked its driver to let them touch it. The first touched its abdomen and exclaimed, "It is like a round basin." The second touched a leg and retorted, "No, it is like a tall pillar." The third felt an ear and protested it was like a basket. Finally the fourth man felt its trunk and said that the elephant was like a bent stick. Thus their limited views of the animal led to an inconclusive argument. The driver finally settled their controversy by laughing and saying, "You have all taken a part of the elephant for the whole of it and so you are all wrong." The mystic worshipped the half-truth of himself whilst the beyond yoga, whole truth which put together both inner self and the external world, waited ignored or misunderstood. Contemporary history plainly foreshadowed that there, scientist who was preoccupied with the external world alone and ignored his internal world would, if he were mentally penetrative enough and temperamentally courageous enough, finally have to turn his preoccupation towards himself. Thus the man who started with the formula "What is the universe?" was forced to finish with its mate "What am I?" Eddington's latest book, The Philosophy of Physical Science, was nothing less than an open confession of the truth of these statements. But the reverse was equally correct, as experience had proved to me. The mystic who started with wonderment about himself would, if he cared more for truth than for delightful moods, be forced to finish with wonderment at the universe. So long as he avoided or neglected the question, "What is the universe?" he himself remained unbalanced and his knowledge incomplete. If we endeavored even for a single minute totally to withdraw any creature from his external sense activity, we would not only withdraw him from the universe but also from his conscious self. For in that condition he would at once be plunged in sound slumber or sudden swoon, when he would know nothing of the I and could never know anything of the I. This indicates that not only is he a constituent part of the world, but the world of sense impression is a part of him, because it disappears together with the disappearance of his ego. Hence the right knowledge of self in its fullness must depend on a right knowledge of this time-fronted and space-backed world. Truth might be won only by a comprehensive analysis of the whole, which necessarily included world analysis and individual analysis. It was much to the merit of German Hegel that he had foreseen by pure thinking the same problem which now confronted me on the different road of mystic experience. He pointed out that individual experience was partial and finite and therefore could not embrace the fullness of reality. So long as it remained what it was, isolated from the universal experience, it was filled with the clash of contradictions and anomalies. But the latter disappeared as soon as we merged the individual in the whole, whose existence was already presupposed and always immanent. Hegel perceived, in short, that the individual could be adequately explained only in terms of the whole, and that when asked to explain its own significance it pointed beyond itself. Thus I moved heretically to the climax of this entire thought process and confronted the final formulae. From what am I? I had graduated at last to what is the meaning of this world experience? And what is the object of all existence? I had come to recognize that the questions involved an ascent from advanced mysticism to pure philosophy itself. Apprenticeship to yoga. There is a fit time for all events, says nature as she ritualistically shows her four diverse faces to us every year. The man who would profit by her silent instruction will follow her ancient and tested method of making all self-revelations only at the appropriate hour. The time has certainly come for me to follow my old revered tutor. Hence the first two chapters of this book are purely autobiographical and may therefore sound egoistic in a work which is frankly of a philosophical character. Nevertheless, their patient reading is essential as a preparation for the correct understanding of a seemingly new departure in my published work. Moreover, readers will not have to suffer this note of egoism again, for it has been my endeavor that nothing personal shall be found in the rest of this volume to detract from its objective. I must now tell in plainer words what I hardly hinted in the first chapter of A Search in Secret India, the first book in which I spoke to my contemporaries. Therein I confessed that long before I met the first half-clothed Indian yogi I had lived an inner life totally detached from my outward circumstance. I spent much of my spare time in the study of recondite books and in little-known bypaths of psychological experiment. I delved into subjects which always have been wrapped in Cimmerian mystery. Nothing has since been added to those unrevealing words. I have kept silent so long as silence served its purpose, but that purpose has now worn itself threadbare. On the other hand, recent happenings have shown that, in the face of continued misunderstandings by the ignorant and constant misrepresentations emanating from certain so-called spiritual ashrams, no less than from the so-called materialistic world, silence has become injurious. All this is but a preamble to the necessary confession and defense that when I first came to India I was no novice in the practice of yoga, no gaping greenhorn seeking to learn the ABC of a foreign art in its native home. The narrow matrix in which heredity attempted to mold my nature I early broke and discarded, for my whole thought and temperament were of another caste. Boyhood Indian monastic institutions where monks are supposed to spend their lives with their thoughts wrapped up in God. Years had been shadowed by a terrible and tremendous yearning to penetrate the mystery of life's inner meaning. with no maps to make its intricate mazes clear, with no guide to show in which direction to travel and what dangers to avoid, surrounded by a civilization which scorned the very attempt as futile, I yet set forth to explore, or rather stumble through, this twilight land. That which frightens most people away from the investigation of mysticism was exactly what first drew me to it. The very depths of its enigma made me want ardently to explore them. I did not emerge unscathed in nerve and body from these explorations in the labyrinths of my brain and the depths of my heart for the soul. I made mistakes and had to pay for them. Chance, however, seemed suddenly to provide a better road. Before I crossed the threshold of manhood, the power of inward contemplation had been laid up as treasure in heaven. The ineffable ecstasies of mystical trance had become a daily occurrence in the calendar of life. The abnormal mental phenomena which attend the earlier experience of yoga were commonplace and familiar, whilst the dry labors of meditation had disappeared into effortless ease. This fugitive bliss of the mystic, which makes the mundane movement seem so poor and pretentious, has not lacked for laureates, as a reference to the world's poetry soon proves. During those spacious reveries when, hitherto immured in red blood and white bone, the mind overstepped its imagined limits, the physical world was left as a remote and alien thing. The physical body, with its inevitable accompaniment of difficult problems and irritating cares and unsatisfied desires, took on a secondary and subordinate aspect, all one's major interest and attention being focused inwardly on this incredible and amazing experience of an enchanting serenity that seemed to lift the mind high above the commonplaceness of earthly existence. In the deepest stage of trance, I seemed to become extended in space, an incorporeal being. When, later, I came across translations of Indian books on yoga in addition to the medieval European books on mysticism, I found to my astonishment that the archaic accents of their phraseology formed familiar descriptions of my own central and cardinal experiences. Thus I had unconsciously enfranchised myself in the kingdom of yoga and embarked on research activities which were one day to lead me far beyond it. But in those days it did not occur to me that I was anything but a stumbling beginner. I had begun to understand man through introspection, but I could only begin to understand life through retrospection. I suffered from that defect of inexperienced youth, lack of self-confidence. My imagination painted vivid, nay, even fantastic, pictures of what might be accomplished given another 20 or 30 years of practice. Consequently, I placed all yogis and mystics who had reached middle age on a high pedestal, whilst those who had finished their fourscore years were veritable supermen in my eyes. The fallacy that all progress was in a continuous straight line confused my reasoning, and it was taken for granted that whoever had practiced meditation for even a couple of years longer than I had was necessarily to be revered almost to the point of worship. That my own evolution went off suddenly at a tangent from constant contemplation of external life as a parade of flickering shadows into strenuous external work amid the high pressure of editorial cynicism and journalistic materialism not long after, or that I could never cross the familiar limit of my further occasional contemplations, taught me nothing. This unexpected change and this tantalizing inability were ascribed to my own personal defects, and I never ceased hoping that one day some sudden joyful burst of progress into an unexplored world would enhearten me. Had I but known it, these failures were more silently instructive than successes. The time came when I could wait no longer. Knowing that India held the tradition of yoga, however attenuated, more livingly today than any other country, I went off finally in its quest and in the hope of finding its chiefer protagonists and of perfecting my technique. I travelled throughout the heat-soaked plains of India and devoted precious young years to such investigations. That knowledge was eventually found profusely written in many books and actually embodied in a few men. Among the latter I regarded the Maharishi and still regard him as the most eminent South Indian yogi. With him I spontaneously relived afresh my earlier ecstatic moods. The life of rapt inward absorption became again the only life that really mattered. Under his influence and that of the slumberous Indian atmosphere, I returned brusquely from my tangential excursion, scorning and despising world activities and world service anew as being nothing more than purposeless and perfunctory whippings of a dead horse. Once again thought was redirected in profound concentration upon negating itself. Once again I gave myself up to repeated practice of yoga as being the highest end of man, whilst the old help that a wonderful spurt of progress into a totally new dimension of consciousness would eventually reward me dwelt perennially in the heart. The description of my profoundest trance experience whilst with the Maharishi given at the end of a search in secret India is accurate as a description of what I felt, although I did not then beyond yoga. Understand the sharp distinction between feeling and knowledge. What I omitted to state and now reveal was that it was no new experience, because many years before I had met the saintly yogi of Arunachala I had enjoyed precisely similar ecstasies, inward repose and luminous intuitions during self-training in meditation. My debt to this truly remarkable mystic was chiefly due for reviving those beautiful experiences within me, a debt which I gratefully acknowledged but which has been amply repaid by the work I have done in making him very widely known to his countrymen, and revered by them in consequence. It will therefore be clear to perspicacious readers that I used his name and attainments as a convenient peg upon which to hang an account of what meditation meant to me. The principal reason for this procedure was that it constituted a convenient literary device to secure the attention and hold the interest of Western readers, who would naturally give more serious consideration to such a report of the conversion of a seemingly hard-headed, critically minded Western journalist to yoga. For the general motive that governed my researches reflected itself in my main aim in writing the book, which was to draw European and American people to this much neglected path to inner peace, that is to serve them. And the general Western attitude was that it had no use for the moribund survival of yoga any more than for other superstitions of a senile and sterile India. I had therefore to show that yoga at least possessed some living value. And this could best be certified by using living persons to illustrate this value. The years passed and my eagerness to unravel the higher mysteries of yoga did not abate, so meanwhile I wrote about the lower ones which were familiar and no longer mysterious. I found in India that the truth about the yoga system was that, in its 20th century practice, it was no system at all, for it had become as mixed as an Irish stew. It was hard to recognize what was mythical and what was mystical. Yoga had been thought largely useless to the modern world because it was held tight by fantastic fakirs in the crippling and unfortunate embrace of superstition. Dogmatic religion had deflected much of it from its psychological goal, whilst primitive magic had distorted another portion of it into a circus performance. I had not come to India to dig up the graves of old eras and rattle the bones of their skeletons. I made Herculean efforts to rescue what was workable in yoga and then turn it into a consciously formulated rational praxis, first for my own clarification and then for the world's. My pilgrimage still went on with its inevitable accompaniment of arduous struggles and unforgettable ecstasies, intermittent disillusionments and glorious revirements. I did not make this pilgrimage alone. An unseen and unknown host increasingly traveled by my side. This crowd of fellow seekers was cosmopolitan and classless. It was scattered all over the planet. Whenever the higher bidding affected my reluctant personal will, I communicated my discoveries to them. Thus my books were born. Those who were tied by duty to concentration upon the turning wheel of modern materialistic existence were able to profit by the findings of one who had made good his own escape. It was not easy for me to write words which would appeal to a practical matter-of-fact age. Sometimes I could hardly understand why, when so many more exciting and objective books were on the market, anyone should want to read mine. But yet there were these misguided folk who showed such a perverse inclination. I could but thank them and my stars for the encouragement given me. What this meant my pen could answer better than myself. May Allah grant such good people length of days. But once again I reached the old position of standing at what seemed an impassable barrier. My connection with the Maharishi did not avail me in crossing this barrier. Many Indians envied me for having plumbed the depths of yoga, for they did not know that I was inwardly dissatisfied with my attainment, but a few friends were perplexed at the knowledge, for puzzling questions punctuated my ecstatic satisfactions. It is true that the ability to throw oneself into a mystical trance is no little matter, the capacity to concentrate thought at will for long periods of time is no common one, the power to enjoy ineffable if temporary peace by a mere inward reorientation of attention is no paltry acquirement. All these and other characteristics of yoga were in my possession. What then was the true cause of this dissatisfaction? Unless this is explained to the reader, he will be perplexed. After one emerged from the state of trance or contemplation, the exalted feeling slowly and gently subsided, leaving at last only a lingering after-echo. Therefore, one had to repeat the experience daily if one wanted to live again in the original condition, just as one had to repeat taking one's dinner daily if one wanted to live without hunger. If one was expert in the matter, one could protract the sweet after-effects for a longer period, but one could not engage in any kind of practical activity without eventually losing it again. Thus the illuminations gained by yoga were always temporary ones. They needed to be renewed daily at the cost of temporary renunciation of practical duties and worldly activities. This transiency of the contemplative state became a serious problem which engaged much of my earnest consideration. That this problem had troubled more experienced yogis than myself became known to me some years ago during one of my visits to the extensive ashram of Sri Aurobindo Ghose, at Pondicherry, French India. There I was once shown a number of letters which he had written to his disciples, and one contained the following paragraph, whose truth struck me so forcibly that I copied it straightway. The authoritative value of this statement will become apparent when it is added that Sri Aurobindo is probably the most famous of living Indian yogis and certainly the best educated one. He wrote, "Trance is a way of escape, the body is made quiet, the physical mind is in a state of torpor, the inner consciousness is left free to go on with its experience. The disadvantage is that trance becomes indispensable and that the problem of the waking consciousness is not solved. It remains imperfect. Moreover, the man who has to live and work in this world, who must share in its activities, caught in its crucible of work, pleasure and pain, must sooner or later turn away from his meditation and resume his activity just as he earlier turned away from the world to resume his meditation. Take what thou wilt but pay the price," said Emerson somewhere with Greek clarity of statement. The price of yoga was world renunciation. The proof that this was so lay in the fact that those Orientals who began to make some progress with meditation and sought further advancement usually ended by listening to the melancholy melody of asceticism and fleeing from wife, family, home, property and work. They took refuge in ashrams, caves, monasteries, jungles or mountains, so that with the world well left behind, their efforts to reach the contemplative mood might be made more uninterrupted and continuous. Seeking the day-long enjoyment of yogic peace, they had perforce to sacrifice the day-long business of worldly living. Furthermore, this plain fact that the overmuch daily practice of meditation inevitably unfitted a man for activity in the practical sphere of existence became increasingly and disturbingly clear to me. Indeed, I had to give up my own career in editorial and journalistic work for a time, partly because of having overdone the practice and partly because of a resultant hypersensitivity which made most environments a torture. It was much easier to write books because this was an activity which could be executed on a remote mountaintop, if necessary, far from the busy turmoils of city life. All the same, I perceived that at least 95% of Western humanity were caught involuntarily in crowded whirlpools and had no hope of escape from them. A complete system of yoga could not therefore be offered as a practical possibility to the generality of people. Then how could a way of life which offered the world a reward of merely intermittent peace constitute in itself the ideal of a perfect, true and integral way which thoughtful persons had ever been seeking? The combination of meditation practice and worldly work was valuable ordinarily only to those who were satisfied with the compromise of imperfect attainment in meditation. There was a single exception, however. The system which formerly prevailed among the Zen Buddhists in old Japan was sensible and practical. Young men who showed a liking and fitness for meditation were brought to the Zen monasteries and trained there for a period of about 3 years. During this time there were no distractions to hinder them, so that the work of mind mastery could go on uninterruptedly. The Japanese masters, with a sense of realism and practicality which their Indian confreres often lacked, did not permit their pupils to overdo meditation or trance but insisted on strict moderation. Contrary to common opinion, the Japanese capacities went beyond slavish imitation.